neuroscientist Bo Lotto and why he says what we see every day is not reality. Remember that dress that caused the internet sensation a couple years ago? The dress that some people saw as blue with black stripes and some people saw as white with gold stripes? Well, neuroscientist Bo Lotto uses that as a popular example of what he has been studying for 25 years, how we perceive the world around us and how it affects our behavior. Lotto, who teaches at the University of London and New York University, has given TED Talks viewed by more than 2.5 million people. And he's published a new book, Deviate, in which he challenges us to see differently. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Bo Lotto, who wants us to challenge assumptions, embrace doubt, and be deviants. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're going to talk about perception, reality, and understanding. To help us on this journey, Bo Lotto, he is a professor of neuroscience who specializes in the biology and psychology of perception. He's also an entrepreneur, two-time TED speaker, and author of the new book, Deviate, The Science of Seeing Differently. Boy, Bo joins us from Argo Studios in New York City. And as always, we want to hear from you. How much thought have you given to why you see things the way you see them? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Bo Lotto, thanks so much for joining us on Maine Calling today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I want to start with the dress. You put this example toward the beginning of your book, and I think it's an example most of our listeners will relate to. And we're talking about that dress that went around the internet a couple years ago that some people saw as blue with black stripes and some white with gold stripes, or was it gold with white stripes? And anyway, I think most people know what we're talking about. But I want to read something you wrote in your book. You say, some people wrote off the dress. Okay, my perception didn't see reality this time, but it usually does. No, I wanted to shout, you never, ever see reality. So the dress was just a drop in the bucket?
Yeah, I mean, what's great about the dress is that it demonstrated at the most basic level that your brain doesn't actually evolve to see the world as it really is, which isn't to say that the world doesn't exist. It does. There is a physical world. It's just that we didn't evolve to see it in any accurate sense. And what I loved about the dress is it demonstrated this at kind of the most basic level of our perception, which is seeing the intensity of light. It doesn't get any simpler than that. And even at that level, we're not seeing the world accurately.
Here's the part that was mind-blowing to me, and I'm still having trouble getting my head around this. You say this isn't just limited to sight, which I can kind of understand. All of us have been to science museums and seen the optical illusions. But you say this is true for our other senses as well, that when we hear and touch and taste things, that's still more a matter of perception than reality.
Yeah. I mean, of course, our perception is our perceived reality, but it's true for all of our senses. And the reason why it has to be true is that all of our senses, we have no direct access to the physical world other than through the information that our senses are receiving. So that could be through the light that's falling onto our eyes or the vibrations that are going to our ears or the friction on our skin. And these are just different forms of chemical energy. But that chemical energy is not colored. It's not sound. It's not taste. In the same way that pain does not exist in the world, it exists in our heads.
Mm. So I was thinking as I read your book about times in which I've had conversations with my husband or other family members or friends, and I'll say, do you remember when you said this? And they say, I've never said that. Do we fill in gaps of what we actually hear and what we think we hear?
Yeah, I mean, we're all the time. And we are really, we're not just filling in gaps. We're constructing the whole thing. And often when people come to understand that we didn't evolve to see the world accurately and as evidenced in the dress, it can actually give people a sense of insecurity. Because if we all walk around the world thinking we have this objective view of it, and when we're told that it's not actually objective, it's subjective, people think, well, what is it that I'm seeing in the first place? And there's actually power in understanding this because it means we can actually become part of the process of making sense. We can be part of the process of creating our perceptions, not just passive receivers of them.
Mm. Well, I'm sure you've done a lot of interviews like this one with journalists who spend their entire careers, as I do, trying to be objective, try to seek out facts and make sense of this fact-filled objective reality. Are we on a fool's errand?
No, because like I said, the world does exist, and we can generate behaviors that are more or less useful into that world. And that's what your brain's trying to do all the time. And it does that through critical thinking. It does that through empiricism. It's trying to do it through trial and error. And so what we evolved to see is what was useful to see in the past, which is not the same thing as what is there. For instance, if we think about color and the dress as a case in point, light is not colored. Okay, the light that falls onto your eye is not colored. What's more, it's a linear spectrum. It's a line from 400 to 700 nanometers. Okay, from small to large. Our perception of light, though, is not a line. It's a circle made up of red, green, blue, and yellow. It has four categories. It also has grayness. It also has brightness. In other words, the light that is in the world is very different from the complex three-dimensional nature of our perception of it. But that perception was useful in the past. It's useful to have four color categories. But that's not a representation of the world, but it is useful. So there are better ways of seeing than others. It's just that what's better shifts with context, and we can only learn that through experience, through critical thinking, through empiricism. And that's what your brain evolved to do.
Mm. I'm going to read from your book again, and this is the last time I'm going to do this to you, Beau, but this is from the chapter Information is Meaningless. And you say, the reason for this is simple. The information from the world that falls onto our senses could literally mean anything. It is nothing more than energy or molecules. Wow.
Yeah. And actually, your listeners can demonstrate this for themselves. And this, of course, goes back to Bishop Berkeley, who tells us we have no direct access to the physical world other than through our senses. And as you just read there, the senses are detecting this chemical or this energy, but it also conflates multiple aspects of the world. So if your listeners were to hold up your finger, for instance, hold up their fingers, and they line up their finger with, say, a large object that's far away, what they can do is they can make it move their finger towards and away from them so that their finger is the same size as that object that's far away. Well, the fact is they're not the same size. But as far as your brain is concerned, they must be, because the energy that you're receiving conflates distance with size. Something that's large and far away can project at the exact same angle as something that's small up close. Or something that's loud and far away can generate the same amplitude as something that's quiet and up close. So this data is actually inherently meaningless because it could actually mean anything. What's more, it doesn't actually come with instructions. It doesn't tell you what to do. What's meaningful about a rock is different if you're a human or an evolving primate than if you're an ant. The world doesn't come with instructions. What's more, we actually are separate from it, which is why your brain evolved to be adaptable, evolved to make sense, and it makes sense by using its history of what was useful to do and perceive in the past.
I want to talk about the idea of inherited perceptions because I do think it makes a lot of sense that we take prior experience in our lives and apply it to new stimuli. You know, kids might assume they don't like green vegetables because they haven't liked them in the past. Or when someone smiles at us, we might assume they're then easy, you know, okay to approach and talk with. But this idea of inherited perception, that somehow we inherit the perceptions of our ancestors, that's a big step.
Yeah, it's actually, in some sense, quite literal, and not just our ancestors, but also our culture. And then, of course, we inherit them from our own personal previous experience. And the reason why this has to be true is because the world changes, which is why your brain evolved to adapt. Evolution evolved to evolve. We're adapted to adapt. And it's because we're constantly trying to determine what is the best behavior perception in the moment. And if all we have to go on is history, and then what we do is we perceive things according to that history, but then the world changes. So then we experience that world and we incorporate that into our history. And so a lot of that history actually we inherited from our ancestors. In fact, I'd suggest even potentially most of it. Most of your life happened without you even there, right? And one example, explicit example, is we come into the world assuming that we look down onto surfaces or that light comes from above. Your brain incorporates the history of physics into its structure. But also you have the history of your culture. So things that we take to be evidently true in our culture can be completely different in another culture. Because what was useful in our culture is not the same what's useful into another, right?
So are you saying that the laws of natural selection not only apply to physical traits, but also to the way our brain perceives the world around us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And because what evolution does, evolution is just a way of shaping your brain, literally shaping the structure of your brain according to trial and error over the course of millennia. But we also have sort of an internal evolution, which we call development and learning, which are different mechanisms, but for the most part doing the same thing, which is shaping your brain according to the history of trial and error, of what worked and what didn't work, usually what didn't work, right? And we have that from minute to minute, hour to hour, day to day, and in the case of evolution, over thousands of years.
How does it help us to understand that what we're perceiving is not reality, that information is meaningless? Now that you've told us this, what do we do with this knowledge?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in some sense, that's really what the book is about, which is trying to create a context for people to become part of the process of seeing differently, become part of the process of taking ownership of their own perceptions. Because you can't begin the process of seeing differently if you don't understand the principles by which we see in the first place. If you think you're walking around seeing the world objectively, why would you ever question whether or not you might want to see it differently? But as soon as you understand that your brain is making it up, and I don't mean it means the world is an illusion, that's a silly idea, but rather that it's making it up through the process of trial and error and engaging with other people in the world, it means that you now have the possibility of actually changing your perceptions. And it begins without underlying awareness. There's also, in some sense, a deeper practical important point to this, which is that if everything I'm doing is grounded in my history and everything that you're doing is grounded in your history, this tells us something about how we should enter conflict. Right now, we enter conflict in a way that's really about trying to prove that the other person is wrong and to shift them towards us. And they're trying to do exactly the opposite. But if I enter conflict knowing that my perceptions of whatever it is I'm in conflict about are grounded in my biases and my biases I inherited from my culture, it means I need to enter conflict in a different way. I need to enter conflict with a question instead of an answer, with uncertainty instead of certainty.
Does that work if only one side of the conflict is entered into this journey?
It's a really good question. And I would suggest that ultimately, yes. That the reason is because the object of conflict should be learning. Conflict is really one of the only places your brain can actually learn. To be presented with a situation that's different from what you expect creates the possibility of learning. So in a sense, you and I are in conflict right now. You're learning something about me and I'm learning something about you. But we're actually enjoying it. Why? Because we're actually trying to learn. I'm not trying to convince you of anything. And you're not trying to convince me. But in other situations, we enter conflict with the exact opposite intention. And then we see it as negative. Right? So the possibility of learning conflict means actually it's a better chance of winning. And we also know the most successful systems, the most successful people are also the most adaptable. And this is one mechanism by which you adapt.
We've talked a little bit about natural selection, evolution, and being adaptable. I want to talk to you, though, about the sense of how our perceptions are shaped by evolution versus the pace of change in today's world. Are we equipped to deal with, to adapt to this pace?
That's another great question. And in some sense, yes, and in some sense, no. Your brain can change in a moment through a single experience. So we can adapt very quickly as an individual. How much we can adapt at any point in time is a great question. What's more, that in order to really change, you also need a stability from which to change. So you don't necessarily always want to question everything. I don't want everyone going out there. And actually, one, I want them all accepting that they have biases and assumptions, that every time they open their eyes, every behavior they do has inherited biases and assumptions in it. And then the next step is to figure out what they are, and then finally is to question them. But we can't question every single bias. We also need some certainty from which to step into uncertainty. And so there's a tremendous interplay between that, and that will affect, of course, the pace of change.
Bo Lotto, you founded something called the Lab of Misfits. Tell me about the kind of experiments you do there and what you've learned from them.
Okay, so the Lab of Misfits is basically a collection of misfits, and what we do is...
And you mean that as a compliment, right?
I mean that as a compliment. In fact, the whole book of Deviate is about basically celebrating people's deviance, celebrating their misfit nature. And I can go into that if you like later, but the Lab of Misfits is basically, it is a real lab, but we create pop-up spaces, and we basically turn the lab into a theater nightclub. And the reason why we do that is because your brain evolved in a body and a body in a world. That's where you make decisions. And a lab is just a theater. And if you really want to understand human behavior, you have to understand how we behave in the wild, how we behave in our natural habitat, rather than in the confines and constraints of a laboratory setting where people behave in a way they think they're supposed to. So effectively, our aim is to create insight. And we bring people into this theater nightclub setting, but everything in the space is an experiment, right? And so we're getting an insight into whatever it is that we're focused on, might be uncertainty or risk. And then we give it, and people are dancing, they're drinking, and et cetera. And then we actually give the data back to people. So we call it the reveal. So they walk away not only with a cultural, theatrical experience, but also they walk away with a better understanding of themselves.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to take a quick break. After the break, we're going to ask Bo Lotto about how he can apply, or how we can apply, what he's teaching us to creating a culture of innovation and also to leadership. Stay with us. This is MaineCalling.
You make MaineCalling possible, as do Pat's Meat Market, offering meats and ready-to-cook and freshly prepared foods. Located in Portland's Deering Center, patsmeatmart.com. And Andra Scoggin Bank's Main Street Foundation, now accepting applications for the 25K for Kids Award. mainstreet-foundation.org.
Cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay is a project decades in the making, and scientists say it's finally working.
When I first heard that spawning sturgeon were back in the bay, my reaction was, yes, we can get this done.
Now the program's funding is in jeopardy. I'm Ari Shapiro, the fate of the Chesapeake Bay cleanup, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock. This September, Maine Public will be airing The Vietnam War, the new Ken Burns 18-hour documentary. We are planning a series of pre-screenings across Maine, and in preparation for these events, we are looking for Vietnam veterans who are willing to share their own story on the Vietnam War and any correspondence they had during the war. We'll archive these submissions on our website, and a few will be recorded for broadcast by students. If you're interested or know someone, please send your testimonials and stories to mystory@mainepublic.org. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Perception, Reality, and Behavior. On the line with us is Bo Lotto. He's a professor of neuroscience who specializes in the biology and psychology of perception. He's also an entrepreneur and a very popular TED speaker. We're talking about his new book, Deviate, The Science of Seeing Differently. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. There's lots of talk right now, Bo Lotto, about the idea of innovation. How does what you have learned, how can it help someone, an individual, or maybe a company better innovate?
Yeah, so innovation, we have to remember, has two sides to it. So it has both creativity and it has efficiency. and Jobs said, you know, innovation is a great idea that ships. So the problem often, is that companies, they'll start with creativity. They'll have a great idea, and then they quickly move to efficiency. That's also a good idea. And they focus on process. The problem begins when they then stop, and they keep focusing on efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. And that's a great idea if it weren't for the fact that the world changes. And as the world changes, they find they become increasingly inefficient, so they then try to maximize efficiency even more. What they often don't do is start the process again, to start, go back to creativity, back to a question, and then become efficient again. So innovation is actually a cycle. The aim is not to be at the edge of chaos. The aim is to be at the edge of chaos on average. So you have to move between efficiency and creativity. The challenge is that they require different kinds of environments. A great environment for efficiency, for maximized efficiency, is competition in biology. That's a great idea. But it's a very bad idea if you're trying to maximize creativity. And whereas creativity requires understanding that you have biases and revealing what they are and then questioning them. The biggest challenge for creativity to seeing differently is stepping into uncertainty. The very place that our brains often evolve us to avoid is to not know. That's a very scary, dangerous idea for almost all of us in almost all of our settings. And yet that's the place, the only place you can go if you're going to see differently. And that requires a particular kind of environment to hold people in that space, hence the power of leadership.
We live in a world of focus groups and marketing surveys. You don't put a lot of faith into those, do you?
No. And of course, they can inform us. There are a couple of reasons. First of all, a lot of time, those surveys are asking database questions. And what we know from the most basic principles of neuroscience is that the data that your brain is receiving is meaningless, as we discussed before, because it could literally mean anything. It doesn't tell you what to do. So people working on big data by itself has no inherent value. It is potentially useful, but that's all about how you interpret the data. And so often these questionnaires are asking easily measurable things like where and when and what and who. But what they often don't ask is why. Right? So what they're trying to get is data that's easily measurable, and you can determine a rule from that. But really what you want to know is why someone does what they do, not what did they do. And the other reason is that often people don't know why they do what they do. Because, first of all, often people don't realize everything they're doing has a bias and an assumption that often they inherited. But often, even if they were to accept that, they don't even know what they are. And I say they, I include myself in that. The brain hides its own biases from itself. And often these biases are hugely valuable. Every time you take a step, you have hundreds of biases that the floor is not going to give away, your legs aren't going to give away, but, you know, they keep us alive. But they also constrain us. They constrain what the next most likely possible is.
Well, how do you advise us to try to find our own biases and realize which ones may be useful and which may be getting in the way?
Yeah, great question. So often the best person to reveal your own biases to you is not you. It's someone else. Hence, the power of diversity of groups is a case in point, right? If you give me two groups, one a lower average IQ from a different backgrounds, and the other one a higher average IQ on average from very similar backgrounds, I would want the first group. Why? Because they will accidentally or purposely reveal each other's biases to each other. Given a supportive, promising environment, not a competitive environment, but a playful environment, right? But what's more, there's what we call your space of possibility. Their search space is far more complex because it's made up of a more complex set of biases and assumptions, right? And we know from mathematics that the best solutions are most likely to exist in a complex search space. And the kind of diversity that we like to play with is the diversity of the expert with the naive. Why? Because experts are very efficient, but they're usually useless at asking good questions. Whereas naive are great at asking questions, but they don't know that it's a good question. But the expert can recognize a good question when asked. So it's often a very useful combination.
We're going to start by going to Felix, who's calling from Milo. Hi, Felix. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Felix, I'm going to ask you to call back. We completely cannot understand your connection. We'll go to Katie, who is, let's see here. We'll go to Katie, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Katie. Go ahead.
Hi. This is a fantastic show. I wanted to make the comment that everything that you're speaking of today pertains to the perception of pain.
Very much.
And it's fascinating to think about, you know, I just love the comment that our brain is hiding these biases from us, that many times we perceive pain more or less based on our history, based on our previous experience, and that maybe when we feel pain in such a way, we can look really at the true perception, maybe try to focus on that pain more and see, does it really hurt as much as I think it does? And there's all sorts of different ways of modifying the pain. And it's not to say that pain isn't real, but that there are ways of changing your perception. And I think this is something that, you know, may even relate to the opioid crisis and, you know, trying to get people to perceive their pain based on the reality rather than the history, et cetera. Maybe we can reduce our need for pain management, et cetera.
Bo?
Yes. Yeah, it's a really good point. Thank you, Katie. So, and pain makes also explicit the fact that our perceptions are in our minds, the construction of our minds, because, of course, pain is not a function of the world. Pain doesn't exist if we're not there to perceive it. Pain is a clear example of perceiving the significance of something, but not the something itself. And you're very right to say that pain is also very contextual. And in one context, the same stimulus can feel very painful. In a different context, it cannot. And also we learn what's painful. And yes, we also learn the concepts of pain. So, for instance, if I say, let's try a little experiment. Let's see if this will work on the radio because it's kind of a visual experiment, okay? So imagine a star-like shape, okay? And now imagine a cloud-like shape with lots of rounds and curves. And if I give you the word kiki and I give you the word boo-boo, which one is kiki and which one's boo-boo? It'll be the sharp one. That is kiki, right?
Yeah.
And the reason is because that has everything to do with your perception of pain and your assumption of pain, we think. Because your brain has an overrepresentation of sharpness and roundness. So if I give you the words love and hate, you'll think that the hate is actually represented by the sharp shape. Why? Because hate is also a painful concept. And if I prick your finger and I say hate, I can actually activate the same parts of your brain. So pain is actually very conceptual, which doesn't mean that it's not real. Of course, we feel it, but it's there for a reason. It helps us to avoid things, but it's necessarily a consequence of our brains and our interactions with the world.
Right. And I think that some people, unfortunately, have a nervous system that might sort of hang on to the pain concept, and it's much more difficult for some people to modulate that pain. And that's, you know, maybe the people who develop chronic pain, where maybe even the source of the pain has now healed, but they continue to feel pain because their nervous system is primed to do so.
That's absolutely right. In fact, a great deal of the pain people experience is very difficult to find an actual pathology within the body that is the source of that pain, which isn't to say that it doesn't exist, because it could just be that we don't have the ability to detect it. But it's also possible that these are pains that we are nonetheless feeling because of our history. And how do we support people in getting out of that history? Because, of course, it's incredibly real. Mm. As real as seeing the color red.
Katie, thank you so much for your call. We are going to try to go back to Felix. Felix, are you there?
Yes, I think so.
Oh, that sounds so much better. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, back in the 70s, I took a college course for speed reading. Now, the first thing they told me was your normal eye movement for a human is vertical in nature. In order to read, you have to go horizontal with your eye movement. So we spent a bunch of time training our eyes to read horizontally. Now, question, do you think, just for an opinion, that changing your you know, vertical to horizontal influence from your eyes might have an effect? And secondarily, should books maybe be written more vertically instead of horizontally?
I'm quite happy with them being horizontal rather than vertical. But and what do you mean by have an effect, by shifting your the basic movement of your eyes from vertical to horizontal? Have an effect on what?
Well, what they said that people were poor readers because they had an affinity to have a vertical eye movement. So when they read across the page, the eyes would wander upwards, and then they'd have to bring the eye back down to carry on with the sentence. So that slowed them down.
Yes. So I'm not quite sure what it is you're wondering, though.
Well, I'm just wondering if that changes your perspective onto reality.
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting point in some sense that of course, how we move our eyes will determine the nature of the information we abstract from the world. And what's fascinating is people, for instance, in the East, in the Far East, tend to have different eye movements than people in the West. People in the Far East tend to look, say, if I show you an image, we'll look at the background of the image rather than the foreground, whereas people in the West will look at the foreground. Children and adults will look at images differently. They have different kinds of eye movements. In fact, if I were to put you in different states of power, which is possible to do even within 5 minutes, if you feel in a low state of power, your eye movements will actually change as you look around the world than someone who is feeling in a high state of power, which is remarkable because, of course, your eye movements are determining what it is you take in from the world. Right? And that then becomes the data by which you will then create your perceptions. And what you perceive will then alter your eye movements. And often your eye movements will move in a direction that confirms what you assume to be true already. Right? Because we're constantly looking for evidence that validates our current beliefs. And this can also be true even at the basic level of eye movements.
Felix, thanks so much for your call. It seems to me some of, or maybe much of what you're saying, Bo Lotto, is that we are looking for evidence to confirm what we already believe can very much be applied to the political realm today.
Oh, for sure. So it's called, it's a well-known bias that we come into the world with, which is called the confirmation bias. And the reason largely for it is that we hate uncertainty. We hate not knowing, because to not know was to die. To not be able to predict increase the chance of death, right? The better you are able to predict, the more likely you are to survive. One consequence is that we tend to avoid uncertainty. We hate uncertainty, in fact. Seasickness is a consequence of uncertainty, where your inner ears and your eyes are in conflict if you're down below in a boat. So we literally feel stressed when we get into uncertainty. In fact, the stress resulting from uncertainty can be one of the biggest causes for our emotional unwellness. You know, your brain cells start dying. They become less adaptable. You become a more extreme version of yourself. If you're liberal, you become more liberal. If you're conservative, you become more conservative. You go to a place of familiarity. And so it's so powerful that we will look for evidence that confirms what we already believe. Why? Because to do so prevents us from going into uncertainty, which is why one of the biggest challenges for seeing differently, for creativity, for being open, is to be able to be with an uncertainty, to be able to go to that place.
Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Here's an email from Nathan. Reading the book or even listening to the show and being open to these ideas would seem to suggest that a person might already be open to them. How would your guests suggest to those with a seemingly self-assured, concrete worldview, comfortable in their own paradigms and reluctant to let them slip away, that his is a valid concept?
Yeah, so that's a very good point and a challenging one, which we, of course, confront all the time when we're in conflict with someone who's so resolute and so certain about their view. And we know many of those people, especially in politics now. And so how do you convince people to enter into a conflict with the possibility that they might be wrong? And that's very challenging. The way we do it is we tend to, that's really why I wrote the book Deviate, because I'm focusing at the level of perception. I'm focusing at the level of seeing colors. In fact, I would argue that the principles for understanding how and why we see color will inform what it is to be human. And so if I can show people that even at that level, you're not seeing the world accurately, you're seeing the world usefully, then the hope is that if it's true there, then it has to be true all the way up. Right? And what's more, we can ground it in neuroscience and science rather than just a concept or an idea. And so that's one approach, is to give people doubt. Doubt is a wonderful thing. If I can create doubt with courage and enable people to enter a conflict with doubt, then they have the possibility now of learning rather than just winning.
We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions for Bo Lotto. Please stay with us.
You make Maine calling possible, as do Mid-Maine Restoration, specializing in steeple and tower restoration throughout Maine and New Hampshire for over 25 years. Maine-steeplejacks.com. And Jade Integrated Health, collaborative acupuncture, physical therapy, massage, and yoga in Portland and Brunswick. JadeIntegratedHealth.com.
What do an indie music giant like Bon Iver, a 16-piece cumbia meets big brass band, and a legendary songwriter like Paul Simon have in common? They've all been guests on The World Cafe. I'm Talia Schlanger. I host the show where we tie together an eclectic mix of artists, all united by one thing. They sound amazing. Let's dig on them together next time on The World Cafe.
Join us for World Cafe Monday through Thursday and Saturday evenings at 9 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. And ahead in about 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, the Commonwealth Club of California welcomes a conversation with former Olympic athlete Caitlyn Jenner, who, as formerly as Bruce, is perhaps one of the world's foremost prominent transgender women. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program, Perception, Reality, Behavior. We're talking with the author of the book, Deviate, The Science of Seeing Differently, Bo Lotto. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Bo Lotto, by the title of your book and the conversation we've had today, you want all of us to be a little more deviant. How would you recommend we go about starting that at 2 o'clock when this program is over? What kind of exercises can we all do?
Exercises to be deviant. I mean, that's an interesting question. So a number of things come to mind. The concept of deviance is a wonderful concept. And in some sense, it's really just about being yourself. And I don't mean that in a trite sense. I mean, if you think about a group of men in a room, if you were to do a Venn diagram of all those men, you would then have a large overlap of all those people, and that the overlap bit is actually basically all what is the average man in that room. But the bits that don't overlap, the bits from which they deviate from normal, is actually what defines them. So to love someone is not to love their normalness or their averageness, it's to actually love their deviance. It's to love how they deviate from average. So it's really about celebrating and being with those deviances. How you deviate is what, in some sense, defines you. And what's wonderful about that is that those deviants actually come from your history, your biases, your assumptions, which enables you to then make a step to the next most likely possible. But because you have different assumptions and biases, it means you might go down a different path and take different steps than someone else. And so what's necessary for that is to have the courage to do so. So one exercise would be first just to think about what your biases and assumptions might be, ask whether you want to maintain those biases, and then to think about which ones you might want to question and to change, right? And then to have the courage to do so.
We have an email from Andrew. As an artist and illustrator and having taught art students, I'm really glad to hear this topic being discussed. Every human being has a profoundly different perception, and seeing how people draw representational objects is a great litmus test. The goal in teaching representational drawing is not to make better marks on paper necessarily, but rather correcting previously based biased perception. Every drawing teacher will tell you that when you ask students to represent abstracts, they are far more accurate and impartial.
That's wonderful. I mean, art is a wonderful way of getting people to become familiar with their own biases, and also it creates that space, the necessary space for people to be able to question those biases, because again, that's such a potentially dangerous, scary thing that we need an environment in which to do so. But it also speaks to the whole concept of creativity itself. So when you see someone being creative, often what we mean by that is that it looks like they're putting two things that are far apart together and bringing them together. And we think, wow, that's creative. How did they do that? How did they bring these two things that are far apart together? Well, the most likely answer is that for them, they aren't far apart. They're just making a small next step to the next most likely possible, given their space of possibility, given their bias and assumptions. It's for you that they're far apart. So each of us has our own space of possibility because each of us has our own set of bias and assumptions. So creativity is really just about making a small step to the next most likely possible, but then changing what's the next most likely possible by changing your biases and assumptions, by questioning, the power of questioning. And art and theater and, I'd argue, science, and this is really what teaching and education should be about, is creating that environment that enables us to discover what those biases are and to expand them, not just to shift them, but to expand our set of biases.
Another email from Mark. Obviously, bias colors perception. Politicians demonstrably explain their perceptions of events in a way that fits their agenda, as so many of us do. For a personal example, as a physician working in an acute care setting, I'm often asked by other doctors to care for a patient based on a diagnosis they have formed, such as a pneumonia based on their perception of a chest X-ray that may be, in fact, a chronic or normal variant finding. The diagnosis chosen fits their need to finish with the patient and move on. I, in turn, may make an alternative diagnosis that may be colored by my own needs or experience. We have to be on guard for our biases altering our perception.
Absolutely. And again, these biases are very useful. So he will have lots of biases that enables him to see things that I could never see, because he'll have a more complex set of biases in his sphere of expertise. But he's absolutely right. We need to become aware that we have these biases, because if we don't, change begins with awareness. Change begins with knowing that we have these biases, because only then can you have the possibility of revealing them and then questioning them.
We're going to head to Anne calling from Tenants Harbor. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for this show. Ten years ago, I had an experience where my perceptions were altered by a health condition. I was traveling in the Bahamas, and I contracted something called ciguatera, which is connected to a neurotoxin that is found in fish that feed on the coral reefs. What happened was I had many different symptoms, but the one that was really most dramatic was that if I drank a very hot cup of tea, it tasted ice cold, and if I drank something very icy, it felt like it was burning hot. I knew from my own experience that this was not truly what was there, but that was the experience I was having. And it has made me think, how can we change our perceptions? If this neurotoxin could change my perception of hot and cold, what else can the brain do?
Yeah, it's a great example of becoming aware that your perceptions are being altered, but not being able to do much about it. So a lot of our perceptions are called cognitively impenetrable. We can't necessarily just think them to be different.
So
in your case, of course, you're being hit by a pathogen. But in a lot of cases, what's required then is action, is behavior. Now, thinking is an action. It is a behavior. But often what we have to do is we have to put ourselves into an environment that often expands and challenges our biases. And that's the power and beauty of travel, right? That's the beauty of reading books. And that's also the beauty of the best technologies. They enable us to see what we couldn't see before. They make the invisible visible. A telescope, a microscope. I mean, as a consequence of the telescope, we suddenly became not the center of the universe, but just one planet around one tiny star in a massive universe. Completely changed our perception of who we are. So to change our perceptions can be done through pathogens like that. And, of course, we know about hallucinogenics and the power of, say, psilocybin and getting people to change their perception about depression. But also it can happen through just putting yourself in a more complex environment that's different, not necessarily too different, but different enough from your current normal experience, but entering that with an open mind rather than a closed mind.
Anne, thanks for your call. Moving to Portland, Maine, and Connie. Hi, Connie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I wondered where it fits in this discussion of perceptions, raising four boys alone and working hard to get things done in life the right way. I would come across dilemmas. I never wanted to fix them. I never wanted what one of my sons said I wanted, which was control. I wanted to understand, and I wondered where that fits in this discussion. Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a really good question. So understanding is so much, is so tremendously important as opposed to, I'm a huge fan of understanding as opposed to just knowledge about facts or data. Why? Because especially when it comes to other people, like you with your son. So whereas you can measure what they're doing and how they're doing it, where they're doing it, what you can't do is measure their why. Right, we can't, in the same way I can have no direct access to the physical world, other people are just the sources of meaningless data. I have no access to their heads. I have no direct access to the why they do what they do, whereas I can have measure what they did, right? And so every personality that you perceive is actually inside you projected outwards. In the same way that surfaces and light are not colored, so true is for other people. We color other people. We project our meanings onto them. We project our why onto them. And so the only way to deeply understand someone is by embarking on a process of asking questions and literally trying to understand their why, not our projected why, onto them.
Our last caller was a mother raising four boys, but you also talk about leadership and somebody leading an organization. How is understanding our perception and our reason behind our perceptions helpful in changing the way we lead others?
Yeah, so in my view, the greatest leaders are how you lead others into uncertainty. Okay, and so, for instance, there are three qualities of leadership that are associated with any one company. Lead by example, admit mistakes, and see qualities in others. To lead by example is to create a space that's about trust. Because we can't go into the place, the very place that evolution gave us as a solution to uncertainty, which is play, without trust. And to celebrate diversity and to see qualities of others to celebrate diversity and also to admit mistakes is to see that uncertainty and questions and failures are valuable. These are all the qualities of play. Play is evolution's solution to uncertainty. This is the place that enables us to challenge our previous biases. And so this is the power of understanding how and why to see differently, which is you have to create that environment, and fundamental to that environment is the leader and how the leader creates that ecology of innovation, the ecology that enables people to ask questions, but also has the ability to shift from that into efficiency and to move back and forth. So really, it's about how you lead others into uncertainty, how you enable others to see differently. In fact, I'd suggest that far more important to trying to get ourselves to see differently is to create an environment that enables others to see differently.
Bo Lotto, his new book, Deviate, The Science of Seeing Differently. Lotto is professor of neuroscience who specializes in the biology and psychology of perception. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Woodward ran our board today. Dan Plummer answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our archives at mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, biking in Maine. We'll talk about road safety and hidden trails, as well as deciding between repairing or replacing your bike. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.